No one invention has brought with it so great a relief for our mothers and daughters as these iron needle women. Indeed, it is the only invention that can be claimed chiefly for women's benefit.
That was the New York Times in 1860, welcoming a machine that it claimed would set women free. A machine that could sew. Whether you were rich or poor, sewing was women's work in the 19th century. But now there was a machine that could do that work in a fraction of the time. So, if you were a woman, did this gizmo liberate you? The answer, it turns out, depends entirely on what type of life you were living before the machine was invented, and perhaps what you thought of as liberation. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. I'm Tim Phillips. My guest today is Philip Arger of the University of Mannheim and CEPR. He's going to tell us the story of the sewing machine across half a century to find out who it really set free and who it did not. So, what work did this iron and needle woman promise to replace? Before the sewing machine was invented, of course, every stitch had to be sewn by hand. In 1843, Punch magazine in London published the poem The Song of the Shirt by Thomas Hood. He based it on the life of a real English widow called Mrs. Biddle.
With fingers weary and worn, with eyelids heavy and red, a woman sat in unwomanly rags, plying her needle and thread. Stitch, stitch, stitch! In poverty, hunger and dirt, and still with a voice of dolorous pitch, she sang the Song of the Shirt.
This was not just poorly paid, but also tedious and repetitive work. In 1860, the American magazine Godey's Ladies' Book, the most widely read women's magazine in the US at the time, did the arithmetic for us. A man's shirt, it reckoned, took
20,620 stitches and 14 hours 26 minutes
to sew by hand. This miraculous new machine could do the same job, it reported, in an hour and a quarter. So who had invented this sewing machine, and when? Philip Arger of the University of Mannheim explains.
The first mechanical sewing device was invented already in 1755 by Charles Frederick Wiesenthal. So he was a German-born physician and inventor who actually lived in London at that time. But the first really practical lockstitch sewing machine was invented by Elias Howe in 1846, almost a century later. So I think one can say the sewing machine is really an American invention.
Howe held the patent for the sewing machine. But Howe's machine barely worked, and he barely sold any of them either. The man who put the sewing machine into American homes was not really an inventor at all. He was a salesman and an actor whose name you will no doubt recognise, Isaac Singer. The thing was, Singer didn't think much of either the sewing machine or the women it promised to liberate. As his biographer Ruth Brandon reports, when he saw it, his first reaction was disgust.
What a devilish machine! You want to do away with the only thing that keeps women quiet? Their sewing!
But he took the job anyway. For the money, he said.
I don't care a damn for the invention. The dimes are what I'm after.
Singer and his partner Edward Clark sold the machine on installment plans, marketed it to households, and built one of America's first great corporations. But how fast did the sewing machine spread, and who bought it? Philip Arger again.
At the early phase of the diffusion of the sewing machine, so like before 1860, most of these machines were actually used in industry.
Uh-huh.
It was rarely used in households. It was actually quite costly to own a sewing machine. It was considered to be a luxury good if it was done for household work. And so like the only wealthy ones could really afford to buy one. That changed around the mid of the 1860s when Isaac Singer actually introduced his new model, which basically became an affordable tool for many households. So like annual sales, they really went up from a few 10,000s to more than 600,000 annual sales in the US at the end of the 1870s. By then, it was estimated that about half of the US households actually were able to own a sewing machine.
But before the machine arrived, what did sewing actually mean in a woman's day? Well, it depends on which social class you belonged to. For poorer women, sewing was a way to earn a living. For middle-class women, it was more of a domestic duty.
Yes, sewing was done by hand, and in the household, it was a routine task done by women. For income, it's a little bit different at that time. So like, you know, we had seamstresses, dressmakers that made some living out of, for example, producing custom dresses, or people were sending their clothes to women in their homes. And then like basically seamstresses were producing and repairing these clothes. I mean, there were also some males involved in that. Like tailors, of course, were making also coats, trousers and shirts by hand stitching, but it was mostly a task that was done by women.
The Times had claimed that the machine would benefit women. So was it right? Philip and his co-author, David Colucha of the University of Bristol, tried to discover how the sewing machine had changed the lives of the women that the Times was writing about.
We thought that the sewing machine should have freed up time for millions of women at home. And so then our question was really like, you know, yeah, how did women use this freed up time? Was it mainly for work or for other activities? Was this response very different by social status? The problem, the sewing machine was maybe not a very usual tool because it was used as a household appliance and also in manufacturing. And so basically it pulled in many young women into factories, but of course it also displaced seamstresses, dressmakers, and that makes this case even more interesting, but also more challenging, you know, in terms of quantifying this effect of the sewing machine.
To answer these questions, they needed to find a place that they could study in detail. It would have to have unusually good records of how people lived at the time. And they found it, Massachusetts, between 1850 and 1900.
Massachusetts was one of the pioneer states in the industrialization of the United States. So in generally, the northeastern region experienced a substantial expansion in manufacturing production and increase in urbanization in the early 19th century. So you can think about that the Northeast had, for example, per capita income roughly 30 to 40% higher than the national average. And urbanization in Massachusetts was roughly around 35 to 40%. We know Massachusetts became an important industrial center, but there were also others like Lowell and Lynn that became popular as textile and shoe production centers at that point in time, together with other several small and medium-sized manufacturing towns. Here we draw on the relatively rich individual census data. That's basically the main data source that we are working with. I mean, we have complemented the census with some other sources that are particularly available in Massachusetts, but like, you know, it's mostly individual census data. They contain information about occupation, fertility, marital status, place of residence. And what's also important in our context is that throughout our sample period, and maybe we're a bit lucky of that, you could say, there's also information provided on the wealth of individuals. So we know how wealthy a household was during our sample period. This information was there in 1860, 1870. And this allows us actually to disentangle the impact of the sewing machine on more richer and poorer women, both as a manufacturing tool, as a household appliance.
If the authors couldn't identify exactly who owned or used a sewing machine, they could identify who might have owned one and which industries were likely to have used them. To do this, they had to go back to the contemporary records.
There is no systematic data available of sewing machine use at the individual level for Massachusetts, so we have to find a way around. And the way how we do that is that we think of that there are two sort of exposure to sewing machines. One is like an industrial exposure to sewing machine, and the other one is an exposure to sewing machines as a household tool. So like basically we have information on industries where we know that they widely adopted the sewing machine during our sample period. And so like basically we expect that in these towns where these industries were initially located, that there is a higher impact on female employment, for example, in these industries. So like, you know, we expect a stronger effect in these locations where more of these industries were initially located before the sewing machine was widely adopted. And for the sewing machine as a household tool, we actually digitized information on retailers from business directories. So we have information about sewing machine retailers that sold this appliance to households. And we use as a primary measure whether like you lived in a town that had access to the first sewing machine retailer in that town. And that's our primary way how we capture exposure to sewing machine as a household appliance.
So first of all, what happens to the lives of working class women who were sewing to earn a living?
What we find is that the sewing machine overall increased the employment opportunities of working class women in these industries that widely adopted the sewing machines, right? This was not only the garment industry, but you can also think about, for example, the boot and the shoe production, where many of these women were pulled into the factories. But we also find some impact on, for example, general merchandise stores that started to sell ready-made clothes and they needed seamstresses and dressmakers in their departments.
But the machine did not necessarily lighten the load for these women. Often, it simply raised the quota. In the 19th century, ambitious entrepreneurs would set up in warehouses and lofts and hire women as labor to satisfy the demand for a new type of cheap machine-made clothing. These establishments were given the name sweatshops. In his book, How the Other Half Lives, published in 1890, Jacob Riis, a Danish-born journalist, created a sensation by reporting slum conditions in the United States. For example, he wrote about a shirtmaker's evidence to the Board of Arbitration in neighboring New York.
She worked 11 hours in the shop and 4 at home and had never in the best of times made over $6 a week. Another stated that she worked from 4 o'clock in the morning to 11 at night. These girls had to find their own thread and pay for their own machine out of their wages.
$6 in 1890, that's about $220 today. But if working conditions were often bad, it was still an opportunity to make money, and one that changed the lives of working women outside of work as well.
So actually we find that for these working class or poorer women, that they started to reduce fertility. Why is that the case? This is consistent with the argument that there were better employment opportunities, and this basically increased the opportunity costs of having children. We also find that there is a decline in the share of married women. This is evidence based on the town level. So here we look at some more aggregates, but then we have also the advantage now that we can follow women over time. So we also link individual data. We find for poorer women that if they lived before the rollout of the sewing machine really happened at scale, if they lived in towns with high industrial exposure, they were less likely to be married when they were young adults. And we can even follow them a bit longer when they completed fertility. And we also find that they had fewer children and many of them remained unmarried when we look at them, say, as 50 or 55-year-olds.
Meanwhile, across town, for the middle classes, the machine had a very different impact. Now, you might assume that if a young middle-class woman in Massachusetts had a free afternoon because she doesn't have to spend it sewing anymore, she might find things to do outside the house. She might even get a job. Well, having done the arithmetic on the ability of the sewing machine to save the time of middle-class women, Godey's Lady's Book had crowned the sewing machine
the Queen of Inventions
and predicted it would give women the leisure for
outdoor exercise.
So, was Godey's Lady's Book correct? Did wealthy women take up outdoor exercise? Or even, did they go out and get jobs?
Not really. So I think at that time, the scope for young middle class and richer women to work was rather limited. There were certain occupations like in teaching, for example, or towards more the end of our period, maybe as in a clerical position that became also available for younger middle-class and richer women. But what we find is that middle-class women that had access to a sewing machine were less likely to work as an adult because they used their free time for earlier family formation. They married earlier, and they also started to have children earlier. And that's consistent with the general notion at that point in time that there was a strong stigma associated with women working outside the home once they were married.
The Queen of Inventions, it seems, was more likely to give middle-class women more leisure time to bring up their children. Later inventions, like the washing machine or the vacuum cleaner, have been identified as freeing women to join the workforce. So why is this a different type of household revolution?
Some of the predictions that prominent researchers have made about the effects of the household appliance revolution on women, we also found in our data. So there is some free time, and we find that once there is free time from, like, you know, tedious housework, women can use this time for having more children, right? The household can spend now the time to have more children. And for those where employment opportunities really became available, so here we're talking about the young, poor women, they entered the labor force. But what I think is different to this type of household appliance revolution that happened roughly 50 years later is that basically at that point in time, there were less acceptable jobs available to women than when washing machines or vacuum cleaners made their way into their household. So for rich young women, we don't see this pattern as it was, for example, observed during the mid-20th century.
The sewing machine changed lives for women in two different ways. Neither poor nor middle-class women experienced the leisure or the freedom that this remarkable labour-saving device had promised, in one case because of their social status, in the other because of social norms. Now today we're living through a new era of labour-saving technologies, one that also promises that we will have increased leisure and freedom. So should we treat this story as a cautionary tale that perhaps it might not work out that way?
I think some parallels can be drawn in the context of developing countries, where you could still think that even if we have labor-saving technologies that had a differential impact on women, in some of these places, traditional gender norms are still often much more common, and therefore they limit the scope of these technologies to liberalize women, similarly to the setting that we have studied in the 19th century Massachusetts.
The sewing machine did free up women's time. It did, for some women, open a door. But what was on the other side of that door was often a version of the lives that they had led before. For a poor woman in a factory town, there was income and a job, though not perhaps the one she might have chosen. For wealthier women, a door had opened, but into the parlour, and not yet the workplace. The paper is called Liberation Technology: The Impact of the Sewing Machine on Women by Philip Arger and David Colucha. It is CEPR discussion paper number DP21496.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian.